Good afternoon, everybody, and thanks for joining us for another Best of Midrats. Today we're going to replay one of our better shows from this spring. Pretty appropriate, I think, for July 4th weekend. We have former Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld and author Bing West. Thank you, everybody, and please join us again next week for another live episode of Midrats. Now, let's get on with the show. For anybody who is interested in history, politics, or national security, I think so far in April 2011, there are two books that should be on your short list that you need to get hold of and you need to read. And we're going to have the authors of both of those books with us today. Our guest for the first half of the hour will be former Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld to discuss his new book, Known and Unknowns, a Memoir. He's a hard act to follow, but our second guest is one of the few out there, I think, that can more than hold their own. The second half of the hour, we're going to have what I think is one of the best authors who is continuing to write the history of the Long War, Bing West. And he'll be on to discuss his latest book, The Wrong War, Grit, Strategy, and the Way Out of Afghanistan. But let's get on with our first guest, Secretary Rumsfeld. Welcome to Midrats.
Thank you very much.
Yes, sir. Glad to have you on here, a regular guest of the show and a friend of mine, Lieutenant Commander Claude Barrabay. He's presently teaching up at the Naval Academy. He asked me if I was a little nervous having you on, and my response to him was, "Well, the last few weeks I've been spending hours upon hours with you. And I wanted to do two things, kind of unorthodox. One is to congratulate you on your book, but mostly to do something different. Usually I tell people they should purchase a book, but I don't want to tell them to do that for your book. I recommend they get the audio book because you narrate the book for the reader. So congratulations on that. That is an effort and a half.
Thank you. It took me 8 days, 8.5 hours of reading a day to do the unabridged version of the book on the audio.
And I think why that is such a gift to the reader or the listener, and why I would recommend that, is a lot of times, as you know, when you read somebody's work, it's hard to get an emphasis. It's hard to get, you know, what exactly did they mean by that clause? Whereas, because you have the first person reading his book, I think the tone of your voice, some emphasis you put in certain areas, it gives a lot more to your book than it would be just reading it by itself, because you can hear in your tone and your emphasis on a few places that just adds an extra paragraph unwritten behind that. So outstanding, well done, and I thoroughly enjoy listening to your book.
Well, thank you. There's another alternative, and I think for the first time ever, to my knowledge, we have what's called an enhanced ebook, so that if you're using the electronic book and you see something of interest and go to the endnote, you can then go direct and say, I quote a paragraph from a memo. You can go and pull up the entire memo off my website, rumsfeld.com, automatically off the enhanced ebook. So someone who's looks at a paragraph and wonders what the context was or what the rest of the memo was about, can actually go and pull it up in real time. I've digitized much of my archive, and we now have something close to 4,000 documents on the website. You know, just tens of thousands of pages.
It's such a great resource, and the beautiful thing about today's technology is once it's on the web, it's there forever. So people who are digging for primary sources 150, 200 years from now when they're working on their doctoral dissertation, they can drill right into it and actually hear you talking about it. It's just it's a wonderful thing about technology. And you mentioned everything in your archive, and the thing I enjoyed about your book the most, and I mean this with the greatest respect and affection, is it's a huge, broad, sweeping story of modern American history. Because of your decades of service, you can almost, you know, lay down a marker. You talk about some of growing up in Chicago, your father's service in the Second World War, but you can really market with your run for Congress, your experience with John F. Kennedy, and coming through to today, it's almost like the thinking man's Forrest Gump, reading especially the early parts of the book. I'm sure we're not the first people to make that point. And
well, it's been described in the Wall Street Journal as the first memoir of the information age of the 21st century. And what's amazing when you think about it is I've lived one-third of the history of our entire country. If you multiply my age, 78 times 3, and subtract it from 2011, it takes you right back to 1776. So it is a broad sweep. It's a long life.
And something that kind of taps into that before we get into some of the real meaty parts, you're the same age as my father. And this was a question that I always like to ask him, because of your generation, you're kind of, some people will call it the forgotten generation. I don't think your generation was ever properly defined, in my opinion. But you came to adulthood with what the World War II generation had delivered to you, with that huge optimism in our country from the late 50s up until, some people say, that era ended when Kennedy was shot, plus or minus a few years. And then in your formative and the years that most people make most of their impact, and you raised your children in an environment for them that was shaped in the late 60s and early 70s in the popular culture by the baby boom generation. So you're doubly challenged by these huge influential generations on the other side. And looking back from when your youth to coming through and raising your family and continuing to serve in the modern age, what do you think as a nation we have really succeeded in bringing our country forward in that time period? And what is there something that maybe we've lost that we should try to get back, or if we can't get it back, at least try to appreciate what it was for?
Well, you know, I was born during the bottom of the Depression and grew up during that period and World War II. And you're right. My Joyce and I were bringing our children up during the late 50s and 60s, and those were often tough times for children. But what I've seen is kind of almost a rhythm, where we go through some good times and we go through some bad times as a country, but the pendulum always seems to swing back and get put back where it belongs, roughly. Even though, I mean, I think of the Kennedy assassination and the Martin Luther King assassination and the during the Civil Rights era when I was in Congress, and the terrible riots in our cities and the violence, and the Washington D.C. was burning, and Los Angeles and Detroit, the periods where there was in public life a lack of civility, the burning of things in at the Pentagon during the McNamara era, the Vietnam era, and the drug use. So we've gone through swings, and people always think that the time they live in was the worst, but I can remember some pretty tough times dating back, and I look at the situation in later periods my personal view is that we had some tougher times earlier.
This is Eagle One, Mr. Secretary, and looking at this book, which is going to be a tremendous historical reference, I would imagine, for some PhD candidates for the next 30 years. Not to get into all the detail of it, but I was struck by what appears to have been a shift in the political climate from when you first started in Congress to the days when you finally left the Pentagon, in the treatment of the political class, the members of the political parties to each other, and in their general posturing as to the political scene. Can you talk about that a little bit? How that changed did it change in your perception as the time went on?
Oh, it has dramatically. When I worked on Capitol Hill during the Eisenhower administration, and then served there in the Kennedy and Johnson era, people were civil. The relationships between Republicans and Democrats were strong, and there wasn't the kind of hostility and political posturing that you see today. It was a notably different time. I mean, all of us had as many friends from the other party as we did in our own party. And a part of that, I think, is because of television. Part of it is the way the Congress now stays in session a long time. And as a result, people seem to leave their families back in their home districts. And they go back every weekend. So there's very little socializing among members of the House and Senate. A third thing that's happened is gerrymandering. Once the legislatures get together and design the districts, congressional districts for the House, what they do is they protect incumbents. And that means that most of the members don't have to compete with the other party. They only have to worry about a primary candidate from their own party. So in the Democratic Party, the risk is for an incumbent is that there'll be someone coming at them from the left. And that tends to pull them to the left. And in the Republican Party, the risk is that someone will come at you from the right. So that pulls Republicans to the right, which kind of polarizes the House of Representatives in a way that, in my view, is unfortunate.
Going to one of the historical parts that you had a big play in back, and just a little personal note, I can't help myself. You could feel the affection you had for President Ford in your book, and as a personal thing, my first real political thought that came to mind is I was a 9-year-old boy, and one of the rope lines when President Ford was showing Anwar Sadat around the U.S. and had an opportunity as a 9-year-old kid to reach out and shake President Ford's hand. And the one memory I have is he had this huge, beefy football player hand that I just hadn't been used to as a young man. So people, whenever somebody says President Ford, one thing I think of is this big, meaty hand. So that's my 1-year-old Ford story. But
that's wonderful.
Yeah. Plus, he had, you know, this. He had a great smile too. He'd look you right in the face. So what a great guy.
Oh, he was just a wonderful, kind, decent human being and an all American type.
When you were his chief of staff during the Mayaguez incident, if you could for a moment, because I think there's lots of lessons in this area that apply today, but the decision-making process that occurred during those days and how the options were weighed by the president and his senior team and how that interplay works between his senior advisors. For the Mayaguez incident, how did that play out?
Well, it was interesting for me as a former Navy pilot. What took place was that because of modern communications, there was a moment in the cabinet room when the president, Secretary Kissinger, the national security assistant, and me as chief of staff. I don't think Jim Schlesinger was there, the secretary of defense, but Schlesinger may have been on the phone with them. And you could actually hear the voice coming out of Southeast Asia describing what was taking place, that a ship was leaving the island. And it had people on it, and their heads were down. And then at some point, the person said, they might be Caucasians, because we're talking about the crew of the Mayaguez was what was the problem. We were trying to find the crew of the Mayaguez. And the president was put in an awkward position, in my view, because of modern communication, where what ought the pilot to do if he's – should he – try to sink the ship? What if they were the crew of the Mayaguez, the people we were trying to save? Should he try to disable the ship by going after the rudder? And to have that voice actually come into the cabinet room, it seems to me that those are the kinds of things that the president ought to be in a position to give broad guidance, but ought not to be put in a position of being asked or people looking at him when the voice comes in. And people look at him and say, well, what do you think? And as president, he I think was put in an awkward position.
As a former Navy pilot and who spent a long time in the Navy Reserve too, I guess that is one of the questions. How tempting is it as Secretary of Defense or a high political official to want to step in and micromanage, and how difficult is it to resist any temptation to do that?
Well, I didn't find it difficult at all to resist it. It seems to me that you have a chain of command, and the people down the chain of command have information, and orders ought only to be given down the chain. I can remember, for example, on 9/11, when there were aircraft, U.S. aircraft, military aircraft, armed, and the president had given an order that in the event that an American aircraft looked like it was going to attack a high-value target like the Capitol or the White House or something, the president gave orders to go ahead and shoot it. And all I could think of was putting myself in that airplane. Hold one second. Put myself in the airplane and think, my gosh, here you got a 25-year-old up there, and he's got to make the judgment as to whether or not that aircraft looks to be on a trajectory that it conceivably could hit an important target. And of course, if you're landing at Reagan Airport, all it takes is a minor turn, and you're at the White House or you're at the Capitol. And but I think it's if one's conscious of it, it's easy to stay out of it. What you do have to do is monitor it. I mean, you're familiar with rules of engagement. When the president or the National Security Council or the Department of Defense fashions rules of engagement, my impression is what happens as you go down to the chain of command, each level of the command takes a tuck in them and tightens them because they don't want to go beyond what's authorized. By the time it gets down four layers, it doesn't even look like the rules of engagement that the National Security Council might have indicated was appropriate.
Another thing you emphasize in your book that I really enjoy, because it's one of my little hobby horses as well, is words mean things. Words have definitions, and you need to be very clear in the words you're using that they describe what is actually going on. And you mentioned you never really liked the phrase the global war on terrorism. And looking back almost a decade since the attacks of 9/11, what exactly are we engaged in?
Well, I tried to find a better phrase, and I never could find one that was sufficiently better that it was persuasive for the president. But my problem with the word war was that it sounded like it was the problem for the Department of Defense, when in fact what we're dealing with here is something that is not going to be won by bullets alone. It's going to take all elements of national power and a broad coalition of people putting pressure through bank accounts, monitoring telephone calls, getting cooperation from other countries, so that everything a terrorist does is much more difficult. So the word war worried me because I had the feeling that the Department of Defense was thought of by everyone else as the solution to this problem, and it isn't. It's more of a competition of ideas. It's less like World War II and more like the Cold War, where we had free systems versus communist systems, and here we have the competition of ideas with radical Islamists. And it's going to take broad activities to reduce the number of people that are recruited, to reduce the number of people who give money to training people to kill innocent men, women, and children. The other problem I had with it was the word terrorism, the war on terror. Terror is a technique. It's not an enemy. It just happens to be a technique that this enemy uses because they don't have big armies, navies, and air forces. So they go after the nation state and innocent free people using the technique of terrorism, and I felt it was kind of a misnomer. But words do matter, and it seems to me it's terribly important. you can see the caution that this current administration is using with respect to using even describing who the enemy is. The Attorney General refuses to use the words Islam or Islamist or radicals, and you find the hearings that Congressman King held were criticized before they even had their first meeting, because people don't want to be seen as against a religion. And of course, the American people are not against the Muslim religion. What they're against is radical Islamists who are out to kill innocent men, women, and children.
Well, that strikes me as one of the things I got out of your book, which I got when you were talking about the Afghan leadership. I love this quote that these men were not saints, but saints are in short supply in the world. And I started thinking about how the war of perception, which is what we seem to be fighting a lot against people like Osama bin Laden, we're always struggling with being a superpower against nomadic tribesmen somewhere in the desert. Could you talk a little bit about along those lines, how we stake out a high moral ground and try and maintain that, when how difficult that is?
Well, it really is difficult. We are looked at as almost all powerful, and of course, the enemy has a brain. So what they do is they don't compete with us where we have power. They compete and against us where we have weaknesses, and it's a totally asymmetric effort on their part, where they watch what we do and then adjust their tactics and techniques. And of course, the reality is a terrorist can attack at any time, any place, using any technique, and it's physically impossible to defend at every moment of the day or night against every conceivable technique in every location. It just can't be done. The other problem you've got is we're talking about handfuls of people instead of armies, and the Department of Defense, of course, isn't organized to do manhunts. That's really the FBI or local police that do that, and even the FBI has trouble. You look at the 10 most wanted, there are people on there for years that they can't find.
There's covered a couple times in the book that you saw at your level, and a lot of other people have discussed it, and I saw it down at my level as a worker bee in Afghanistan, the challenges that come with working with the State Department, most notably the way they assign people, and it's not so much an attitude per se, but it's almost a first reaction to not want to work together, but to parachute in, do what they want to do, and then jump out really fast. And the more I would ask people about it, the word started to come out that State Department needs a restructure, but it's going to have to come from the outside, not the inside. Is that something that Congress needs to act on, or is this just a culture that's in the State Department that we just need to learn to work with and around?
Well, that's a good question, and I took a lot of time in my book in discussing that and trying to analyze it and do it in an analytical way. What we have today, really, in the Department of State is a lot of fine people, intelligent people, and their orientation is to report back what's going on in the countries to which they're assigned. That is a quite different thing from going out and representing the United States of America and our policies in the countries to which they're assigned. So the reporting cables are a major part. I was an ambassador ambassador to NATO back in the 1970s, and I know what happens. You end up spending a great deal of time analyzing what other people in your country are doing and thinking and saying, and how it affects the United States, and then reporting that back. That's a quite different thing from the assignment of helping the United States government and the president implement his policies. And the other problem you've got is, the incentives in the Department of Defense for promotion and success tend to be engaged in things that are important. And if there's conflict going on, it's to be engaged in the conflict. in the Department of State, the incentives and rewards tend to be serving in the big, important countries of Germany and England and in France and so forth, not in places like Afghanistan and Iraq. And what happened there was you ended up getting long delays in people serving in the key spots, empty slots where they didn't have a full complement of people, and then relatively short tours. And, of course, it takes a long time. Of course, the military suffers from the same problem in terms of too short tours, in my view. I mean, they talk today about the possibility of Petraeus leaving Afghanistan and becoming director of the CIA, I think would just be a terrible mistake. He was put in there to do that job. He's a capable person, and he ought to stay there and do it. And I think, you know, if corporations change their leadership as fast as we seem to be doing it in terms of both military and civilian State Department people, I think the companies would go broke.
You did discuss in the book the concept of peacekeeping and governance, corps, I think you call it, to kind of replace, I gather, the idea of having our military people who are trained for a completely different mission than nation building. Could you discuss that a little bit?
Yes, indeed. We did in the Department of Defense when I was there in 05, I think, urge the Department of State to take on a responsibility in that area and have a competence, a core competence that they could rapidly expand in the event those skill sets were needed. I mean, personally, I don't believe you can nation build our country. I think we ought to have a healthy respect for what we can't do. And the idea, I mean, take Afghanistan, the idea that, I mean, that country has, it's tribal, it has a different culture, it has different neighbors, it has multiple languages that are not familiar to our people. They're going to have to build their own nation. We can be helpful and create an environment where they have a chance to do that and give them a chance. And they're getting a chance, and they have a chance. But they're the ones who are going to have to build that country. And so I think it's the State Department ought to have a core competence in that area. And they created a small office, but they've never really asked for funding to get it going in a very strong way. The other thing about the State Department and the Department of Defense is that if you think about it, our government is really, a lot of the institutions were formed at that inflection point at the end of World War II and the beginning of the Cold War. I mean, that's when the Department of Defense, the National Security Council, the National Security Act, the CIA, the IMF, the World Bank, the UN, NATO, USIA, all of these things were formed during the Truman period. And they've served us pretty well for a period of time. But we're in a different era today. The information age in the 21st century and the end of the Cold War is another inflection point. But we really haven't done the kind of adaptation and adjustment that needs to be done. And there has to be a better way for the president to be able to have these disparate threads that come up from his bureaucracies bend in towards him in a way where the threads go through a needlehead in a more orderly way so that he can make decisions. And I just think it takes some attention that we ought to give it. It's an important time, and but things, we've been fighting the first wars of the 21st century, the first wars of the information age, and I just don't think the American people or the media or our government have gotten accustomed to this flood of information that exists. I mean, the tweeters and Facebook, we're seeing in North Africa some of the effects of these modern means of communications. I mean, in World War II, we didn't even have television.
It was amazing. We still managed to fight a war in less than half a decade and take down two very large empires. I think if we could just learn how to leverage exactly what you're talking about, we would be able to get a lot more bang for our buck. Secretary Rumsfeld, thank you very, very much for coming on and giving us 30 minutes of your time this afternoon, a very quick half hour. And I want to remind everybody, you can pick up the book if you want to, Known and Unknowns, a memoir. But if you like listening to Secretary Rumsfeld, get the audio book, and you can listen to them for 8 hours more. And if you could, sir, take for a moment and let everybody know where some of the profits for the book are headed to.
Yes, indeed. All of my proceeds from the book are going to go to the troops and their families and the Children of the Fallen. It seems to me that's the appropriate thing to do, and my wife Joyce and I are happy to do that. So it's a good cause.
Yes, sir.
Thank you, Secretary, and thank you for your service to the country.
Well, thank you so much, Eagle One and Sal. I've enjoyed it. Hope we can do it again sometime.
Yes, sir. We will take you up on that, and have a great spring.
Okay. Thank you. Bye.
Bye-bye. And I would like to thank everybody for coming in, but you know what? The show is not over. We've got another second guest come along we told you about before. Our second guest today is going to be somebody who I think is one of the best chroniclers of what I still refer to as the Long War. And he's here to discuss his latest book, The Wrong War, Grit, Strategy, and the Way Out of Afghanistan. But that isn't his only book and not his own background. I know most of y'all are familiar with his work. Former Infantry and Marine Force Recon Officer, Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Affairs way back in the Reagan administration. He's presently now at the head of Gamma Corporation, but he's written some of the seminal books that need to be in the canon of what we've been doing the last decade, some of which include The March Up, No True Glory, The Strongest Tribe. And he's with us this afternoon for the full half hour. Mr. Bing West, thank you very much for joining us on MIDRATS.
Oh, it's my honor.
And congratulations on the book. And one thing I wanted to come out of the box for, because I am making a transition in my thoughts in Afghanistan as well. I did two tours in Afghanistan in little small roles, nothing fancy. So I had a little bit of a buy-in there. But back in July of 2009 in the Wall Street Journal, you penned an article called How We'll Win in Afghanistan. And you, with your new book out, you have The Wrong War, Grit, Strategy, and the Way Out of Afghanistan. If you could, please, could you talk about the arc of the last 18 months of what may have changed or what new insights that you have seen, and what is the way out of Afghanistan for us?
Well, since I wrote the article for the Wall Street Journal, I've been over there another 5 times, and altogether now I've been over about 10 times embedded with our troops over the last 4 years. What I wrote in the journal was the way to win this is to get the Afghans out front and move to an advisor corps rather than our battalions. And I believe it's the wrong war the way we're fighting it. And I could not agree more with what former Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld just said when he said, "We cannot nation build." And yet our strategy is nation building, and Afghanistan is the wrong war for that strategy. It's insane, and it drives me bananas. All we can do, and again, I agree totally with Secretary Rumsfeld said, but I'm very puzzled how we got into this condition when we had Secretaries of Defense like Rumsfeld and Gates. Secretary of Defense Gates just said last week that we can't do nation building. But that's our strategy. So that's what I say in my book. This, when you're on the ground with our troops, you take a 19 or a 20 or a 21-year-old, and he's trained to be a rifleman, and he knows how to shoot. He knows how to take on an enemy. He doesn't know how to develop a country, and I'm not sure anybody really knows how to develop a country, but that's what we're doing, and we've totally misled ourselves. So the thrust of my book, and the reason I say it's the wrong war is because I think it's nutty to believe that we Christian Americans in the 21st century can go to a heavily Islam, tribal, Afghan society hurtling headlong into the 9th century and teach it how to be a democratic nation in the 21st century. Just can't do it.
Speaking of tribes, this is Eagle One. Have the Red Sox won more than one game yet?
Oh, I knew, Peter. You weren't going to let that go, were you?
Listen, no, I wasn't.
You know, that the Eagle Empire, we're just spotting them a little bit of a head start. But our pitchers have to get better. I mean, they really do. And they will. They will. I have faith in our pitchers. I hope.
Did you notice your accent changed when you started talking about that?
Oh, you guys, we'll see. We'll see come September who goes and smiles in October.
I think one of the most interesting aspects of your book was that you're I gather, about 70 years old, and you're out there in the field with the troops doing all the stuff the troops are doing, except not wearing the armor and not carrying a weapon, I guess, but you're humping along with them through all their adventures in Afghanistan. And that gives you a special ground-eye view of what they're up to. How does that translate to seeing a bigger picture? How do you come back and look for the bigger picture of what we should be doing there?
I'm not sure there is a bigger picture, except that it causes my stomach to turn. I have, on occasion, made the mistake, and I no longer do it, of accepting offers from my friends who are four-star generals in traveling with them. And I am astonished at the pablum that they take in as briefings. Every single insurgency is a bottom-up war. It's not fought in palaces. It's fought out in the countryside and in the ditches and in the villages. And it worries the heck out of me that our guys at the top sit there and believe what they're hearing. I mean, can you imagine, first, that we have a terrific military system, but it's a big bureaucracy. It's a big organization. And can you imagine if everyone in a bureaucracy, there are 10 levels between a four-star general and the platoon, if each one of them just is 5% optimistic, if you will, you know, just a teeny bit of optimism. By the time it gets to the general, it's 50% off the mark. And I really worry that they don't, that they really seem to believe their own myths. I mean, I'm flabbergasted. That's all I can say. You know, I'm out there with the troops, then I listen to the generals, and I keep looking at them and saying, you know, what is it? Where do you get this stuff? We're 10 years into this war. There isn't one platoon I've been out with. There isn't one company that I've been out with that believes that they're building a nation. And yet when I get to the top, they still talk about building a nation with a president by the name of Karzai who stole the election big time and has the most corrupt... Afghanistan is the second most corrupt nation in the world with our money. I mean, I don't get what the generals are listening to. I really don't. I don't understand it.
You know, you hit on something that it's actually not unrelated. It's directly related to what we're going on. That I struggled with a lot in my 21 years on active duty is this culture of what I call happy talk, where just what you said is. Somebody will find there's 10 reports out there, and there's one that's bright and shiny. And by the time that goes up three layers past a colonel, all 10 pebbles are shiny as opposed to just one. And you feel sorry in some ways, though they're smart enough, they should know enough, that by the time it gets briefed up to a certain level, they haven't heard about the other 9 pebbles that aren't shiny. And it can warp decision-making. And in Afghanistan specifically, General McKiernan, is though he took it from the COIN doctrine that was developed, but he started the process of the shape, clear, hold, build for Afghanistan, where you go in and you shape the battlefield, you clear out the insurgency, protect the population, you hold it so you can bring in the Afghan forces, the IOs, the NGOs, the GOs, and then we build... and everybody lives happily ever after, and they grow tulips instead of poppies. But the way it's actually playing out, are we putting forth all this effort in Afghanistan to try to protect people who really don't want to be protected, or at least not by us.
Well, I mean, you've touched on what I've seen, and in my book, I start up north, and I just bring the reader with us when I go from unit to unit, and I tell the story of each area and what the units are doing. And persistently, this idea that we go in and clear an area, no, we don't, because in the first instance, we're fighting the Pashtun tribe, and it's about 11 million Pashtuns that live along the border of Pakistan and go back and forth across the border. And they're first and foremost Pashtuns before they're anything else. So when the pressure on the Taliban gets too great because our forces move in, the Taliban just don't do anything. But none of the other Pashtuns betray them. They never say who they are. So they're still sitting there looking at you when you're passing by. 65% of our casualties come from improvised explosive devices buried in the ground as we're walking along. You cannot bury all those mines in the ground without everyone in the area knowing where they are, and no one's reporting them. And I am so angry about this because I was just out with a platoon, and I was just talking with them at Bethesda and Balboa hospitals, and the point man, whom I knew very well, had lost his leg. The squad leader lost his foot, and the corpsman who was coming up to help them, his right leg is all shattered. And when we were out there on patrol, I was just out with them 2 weeks ago, we were walking along. No one was going to fire at them, but we walked by a house that was flying a Taliban flag, and it was the big Italian salute. And now all three of those young men are crippled for life. And everyone in that area knew who did it. No one turned them in. So the idea that these people want our protection, you can't sell me on that anymore, because they're not doing anything for themselves. And we're not posturing. We don't speak the language. We have no way of closing that gap. And it worries the heck out of me that our generals are still talking that theory, and that dog doesn't hunt, and all our platoons know it.
Well, the theory you're discussing is the coin theory that we can separate the indigenous population from the guerrillas or the rebels. But what you're saying, I guess, is that they're one and the same. It's not a matter of us separating the North Vietnamese army from the South Vietnamese people. This is really much different than that, and so that traditional coin approach won't necessarily work. Is that correct?
That's what I believe. Now, I had a combined action platoon in South Vietnam, and we were 485 days in a village, and I wrote a book about it called The Village. But there, you're absolutely right. The people aligned, either they were with the Viet Cong in the North Vietnamese or they weren't. And those who weren't, They would tell you if they thought Viet Cong were coming into the area. The Pashtuns are different. You do not find them standing up in a way that you did the South Vietnamese, which is greatly ironic. General Petraeus has just started what he calls the Village Militia Program. There are 7,000 villages. And of the 7,000 villages, they're trying it in about 70. So, you know, that makes for a long war if you go that way. And again, in my book, I go through instance after instance after instance, and I try to point out, number one, the valor of our troops, which is really what I stress in my book, is we have some terrific young men out there. And then just turning to the Afghans and saying, look, guys, you're going to have to fight your own war. We're not going to build your nation for you, but we'll give you good advisors, and they'll show you how you can fight professionally, but you're going to have to do the fighting. And I think that's possible. I think that's possible.
Well, let's talk about that a little bit, because that is your exit strategy, I gather, that you discuss in the book. You've pointed out that we just seem to be dumping money on these people, which they're happy to accept. I don't know what they do with it, but they're happy to accept it. And then, but we don't require that they do anything in return for that money, so it's just basically a money sump. How would you approach things differently to get them to do something for themselves?
Well, the first thing I do is I would no longer give away money that way. I believe in a certain level of bribery is fine. So I'd give walking around money to each of our platoons that's out there, maybe $1,000, $2,000 a month that they can use as they see fit as they go along. There are always projects that when you're there, it would break your heart if you see how some people live and you didn't try to help them. But I wouldn't try to give these billions of dollars that we're giving every year through these massive aid programs that are going nowhere. What I would do, and I've suggested to the generals, and I think they're going to do this. I mean, you know what I think is really going to happen? I really think that they're going to do pretty much what I'm saying, except they're going to declare victory as they do it, and that is this summer begin to bring home our regular troops and to begin to bulk up our advisors. And what I saw working best that I indicated to people were these special forces. I mean, they're terrific. But there aren't enough of them. A special forces team has only about 12 sergeants, but their average age is 32, and they really know their jobs. But there aren't enough. And I was down in Marger in a big battle in the South, and the Marine colonel said to the special forces, "Well, why aren't you out there with these Afghans?" And the special forces captain said, "Sir, I only have 12 men. By the time we stand duty, we're on guard duty at night. We can only do so much." And he said, "My goodness gracious." He said, "What about if I give you a regular rifle platoon and some engineers, and they can do all the, you know, the chores for you?" And the special forces captain said, "You do that?" He said, "You got them." So he gave him 50 Marines under the command of the special forces captain, and the special forces captain had a grin on his face that just wouldn't go away for 2 weeks. He now could have people out, some Americans out with every Afghan patrol. He could spend his time with the senior leadership in the Afghan battalion. He could get a night's sleep. And that Afghan battalion did as well as an American battalion. And so I went to our generals and I said, "Well, why don't you do that? Why don't you give the special forces who have the real skills regular American platoons that work for them and do what a platoon can do, and you only need then roughly about one American for every 10 Afghans, and right now we have one American for every 2 Afghans, and I think we're going to go that way. I really do."
And I think hopefully they're going to do that, because I think the momentum is what it is, and hopefully we'll be able to avoid replicating the Soviet situation, where we walk out in peace and then a couple of years behind it, everything falls to crap. And one thing I love about your reading, and you can also see it in your videos, which I know many of them are available on YouTube that people can watch that you've taken with your troops, is you don't forget where you came from, and you have a very honest and open affection for our soldiers and Marines. And I have complete agreement with you. I think the future of this country is fine. The youth of today are great. It's the adults that are a problem. it sounds like a cliche, but it's true. That's the one thing that I regret about leaving active duty is the 18, 19, 20, 21-year-old people. What a great generation they are. People should not speak ill of them. They don't know what they're talking about. But America in general, in the last year, the civilians have had an opportunity through what I consider one of the best pieces of cinematography to be done in a very long time to see our young men as they are and what they've been doing in Restrepo. And it takes place, as you know, in the Korngal Valley. And I think at the very end of it is a very sad moment when they talk about all the great things they've done, because afterwards, of course, we've withdrawn from the Korngal Valley, and we saw last month that we've been attacking al-Qaeda training camps that have now been propped up inside where we once had some of our forces. Is this the template if we do not get the Afghans forces the way they should. Is this a template that we're going to see in Afghanistan as America and the rest of the forces withdraw through 2014? And if so, are we just going to have to find some other way to go back in there and eliminate these camps? What direction do you think that's headed?
Well, I agree with you. First, on my website, bingwest.com, I do have the videos that I took from all the combat and the nature of it, and many of the videos I took in the Corn Gal. I was up there with Sebastian Younger and Tim Hetherington, and I sent them a note, and I said I was really sorry they didn't win the Oscar, because they should have. Restrepo was by far and away the best film.
Absolutely.
I recommend it to everybody. But I do go through what happened in the North in my book at great length and try to show that we gradually have been pushed back. We've lost the battle in the mountains. And when you point out that now we're giving up a lot of that territory and the people, we are. Now we're going back to raids. But you see, I'm comfortable with that for the following reason. Our ability in this war now to use air is beyond anything I ever thought I would ever see as an infantryman. Every single unit going out on the ground now has a small device that enables them to see the same picture on the ground that the F-18 pilot is seeing, all the way down to seeing individuals on the ground. So I believe for the foreseeable future, we will have no problem finding camps of terrorists and taking them out. I'm not as worried as some people are that the Taliban are going to get to Kabul. I don't see that happening. I do see that as we leave, there's going to be a mess in the countryside. But it's always a mess. The only reason we're making it a mess is that we know it's a mess because we're there. I mean, it's the old joke about if the tree falls in the forest but you don't hear it, did it make any sound? You see what I mean? I mean, you know, they're rioting in Africa, they're starving in Spain, the Greeks hate the Yugoslavs, and I don't like anybody very much, the Kingston Trio. all that kind of chaos is going to continue. The only reason we went into Afghanistan was so they would not kill us here in the United States of America. And I believe we can continue to ensure that does not happen, even while we back off from trying to make Afghanistan a modern nation.
Well, that does lead to a great question, though. When, you know, I think you point out that we set out to defeat the Taliban and throw out the terrorist organizations that were threatening us. And
right.
Somewhere along the line, the mission creep
right.
came along, and we
right.
moved to this nation-building thing. How
right.
do we stop that? If we ever go into a place and we just want to kill Taliban and terrorists, Is there a way to get out? I mean, what made us decide that we have to go fix every problem in the world when we could just go in and kill people and break things?
Our arrogance and our morality. Consider what happened. We went in 2001 to attack the Taliban and Al-Qaeda because they killed 3,000 Americans. Then they escaped and they went into Pakistan, and we didn't follow them and finish it. We didn't pursue and finish that war when we should have, which was a huge mistake on our part. And then once we stopped, President Bush, if you recall, said that his religious belief was that all men deserved freedom and that, by gosh, he was going to give it to them in Iraq and Afghanistan. That, I think, was the big mistake. We went too far. And all of America went along with the president because we all felt, gee, if we can do good in the world, we will. Now, 10 years later, we've said to ourselves, well, wait a minute, maybe we went too far. Maybe even I mean, it was interesting listening to Secretary Rumsfeld say that he doesn't believe in nation building, but he was the Secretary of Defense for 8 years. So I think all of us had this moment of epiphany in ourselves to say we've gone too far. So I'm not worried for the future. I mean, I think we could have smacked Gaddafi, gotten him out of power, and then said, that's it now, guys. We're not going to be in Libya any more than we're in Tunisia. You Libyans figure it out. We just got rid of Gaddafi, and that's all we're doing. But we hesitated because we're afraid that once we got in, we're in there forever. So we didn't get rid of Gaddafi. So now we have the worst of all worlds in Libya. We still have this jerk there, and we have to continue to fly aircraft around there for maybe the next 10 years until somebody knocks them off. So I think we have to find a common sense balance where we say it's in our interest to use force. After we've used force, we get back out, but we don't feel that we owe having to stay forever.
I share the same fear you have, Bing. It's that one of the latest trends now with the people in the administration, they believe in the R2P, the responsibility to protect. Some people derisively call it humanitarian imperialism, but you can't solve all the world's problems. And speaking of problems, I know you have an appointment to go to here
right.
in a couple of minutes. So I want to give you a real quick line at the end because you've spent a lot of time with our soldiers and Marines down at the tactical level. If there was, and we know how much they love each other, but if there's one thing standing from the side that if you could wave your magic wand and say, Army, the Marine Corps does this right, you do this. Marines, the Army does this right, you need to do that. What would it be?
I would say to both of them, listen, guys, fighting an insurgency is a police war, and you both know it. But when I go to any rifle company, what do I discover? I discover 10 people who have something to do with intelligence and 140 gunslingers who are out there walking the streets as patrolmen every day. If I go to any police unit in the United States, what do I discover? 50% of them are patrolmen, 50% are detectives. So I would say to both the Army and the Marine Corps, you're not walking the right walk for this war, and you know it. And you have to change, both of you, and have many more who are dedicated to getting the intelligence about those ruthless people, especially the bomb makers in the areas that you are. And you have to do that, and you know you do, and you haven't changed your organization enough to do it.
There we go. And I want to encourage everybody, just pick up Mr. West's latest book, The Wrong War, Grit, Strategy, and the Way Out of Afghanistan. And do check out the videos over at bingwest.com. Mr. West, thank you very much for taking time this afternoon to come visit us on MidRats.
Well, it was my honor, and you all do a great job. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Bing, and good luck to the Red Sox.
Oh, okay. I'll take that. Thanks.
And I want to encourage everybody who's joined us live, thank you very much. And we look forward to seeing y'all next week for another edition of MidRats, and I hope everybody has a great Navy Day.
It's a long way to Tipperary.